This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks so much for joining me on this lovely Sunday afternoon. Is it September? It feels like it, but we need to get through August first. Well, in the next half hour this afternoon, we'll have a review of the week in Virginia politics from commentator Jeff Shapiro and WCVN Richmond. But the main features of today's show are our award winners. Last week, we celebrated the Refugees in Virginia series, which was recognized by the Virginia Association of Broadcasters for Outstanding Public Radio News Series for 2016. We'll take some time today to go a little further back and hear some excerpts from previous award winners from 2015. Including our series on food insecurity in Virginia. First, this winner of the VAB's Award for Outstanding Feature Story in 2015 from Kara Lofton, who has since moved on to do some excellent reporting for West Virginia Public Broadcasting and NPR. In America, death is not something we usually talk about unless we are forced to by circumstance or tragedy, but at hospitals, death is an everyday occurrence, and medical workers must quickly learn to deal with it. But how do they cope? In August 2015, Kara reported on one initiative called The Pause that started at the University of Virginia Medical Center 4 years ago and has now been adopted by hospitals all over the country.
What do you want? Where do you want your baby?
These sounds from an actual training clip from medic video on YouTube are reenacted every day in emergency rooms all around the country, including at the University of Virginia Medical Center. A stretcher, fresh off an ambulance, comes sweeping through the emergency room doors. EMTs, nurses, doctors, and techs run toward the patient, equipment, a room, scrambling, hoping to save the life. It is the irony of this moment, when the patient's life is slipping away, that they, the medical workers, feel so alive. Adrenaline makes them hyper-alert, and their own hearts pump faster, as if willing the heart and the body on the stretcher to keep pumping too. But they are too late. The patient dies, and there's someone else who needs saving. So they put down their tools, clean up, and move on. For the past 8 or 9 years, variations on this scenario have been trauma nurse Jonathan Bartell's reality.
Each time we would attempt to resuscitate them, you know, at times we couldn't save them. And it started to wear on me at times, and I started to notice staff responses to that. And staff responses were often frustration, disappointment, a feeling of failure. You could see pain in the physician's eyes. You see pain in the nursing staff.
In order to cope, he said, most medical professionals stop thinking of the person in the bed as a person, but rather just a body that they are trying to resuscitate. Disconnection, he acknowledges, is necessary on some level, but it can also be harmful and lead to burnout, a state he said he has experienced on more than one occasion. One day, about 2 years ago, after Bartell's team tried and failed to resuscitate a patient, a chaplain came into the room.
We had worked on this patient for hours, and the chaplain came in and kind of stopped everyone from leaving the room, and I'm like, wow, that's really bold. And she said, I'm just going to pray over this patient, and then you all can leave. And I watched it, and I felt it was the act of stopping people. It inspired me.
The prayer portion was hard for him because he said he, like many others at the hospital, comes from a different religious tradition than the chaplain. But he kept thinking about her action.
So the next time we worked on another person who didn't make it, this time I decided to be bold and stop people from leaving. And it just came to me. I just said, could we stop and just for a moment, let's just take a moment to stop and recognize this person in the bed. You know, this person before they came in here were alive. They were interacting with family. They were loved by others. They had a life. And if we could just take a moment as a group of people and just stop and just recognize this person in our own way and in silence, just take a pause and take a break and just do this together, but in silence.
The team agreed.
When it was done, and I only did it for about a minute, and then I said thank you all, and thank you all for all the efforts that we did to try to save them. People walked out of the room, and they thanked me, and they thought it was really awesome. And then other nurses started to replicate this and do it. So I realized I had something that should probably continue. Just by the fact that because other people wanted to do it themselves and felt empowered to do it themselves. It started to carry on and started to actually take a life of its own.
Practitioners at UVA, ranging from EMTs to nurses to anesthesiologists, are now adopting the pause. In 2013, Dori Fontaine, dean of UVA School of Nursing, talked about the pause during a keynote address at a trauma nursing conference. A nurse there, Michael Day, who is a trauma care coordinator at a hospital in Washington State, took the concept back to Providence Sacred Heart Medical Center in Spokane, where it is now being used. The concept is spreading, Bartel said, because it works. The pause has made a big difference for many at UVA, such as EMT and hospital tech Jack Berner, who says it gives him closure.
Death is a word that you have to use in this setting. You can't use other terms to kind of soften it. But again, it makes it so we can actually view the person as a person rather than as a patient that we see on an everyday basis. You can relate more to the case, saying, you know, it's somebody's father or their mother or their sister or uncle, or rather than just somebody you see for 5 minutes, it makes it more real.
Prior to the pause, Bartel said hospital workers processed death and dying two main ways. They either became emotionally numb or they were unable to disconnect the patient's death from their own life experience. Both ways are unhealthy and lead to burnout. What is better, from Bartel's perspective, is to cultivate what he calls a permeable membrane, which the pause helps develop.
And this membrane allows some in, but it also allows some out. So you're able to feel, and you're also able to sense and give back. So I think the best way to cope with that in a healthy way is you acknowledge your feelings when someone dies. You acknowledge the pain of that. But we don't own that. That's not my death. That's not my family. But I can acknowledge that this is a natural process and this is what happens. And I can also acknowledge the pain that I bore witness to in caring for that family and for that patient.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
And by the way, that story 2 years later is still one of the most popular stories on our website, getting well over 100,000 hits. Now for a couple of excerpts from the sequence of stories that won for Outstanding News Series in 2015, both by Jordy Yeager and some of his first reporting for WMRA, on food insecurity in Virginia. One of the most hidden faces of hunger is that of the child. In this report, Jordy took a look at how Charlottesville City Schools and other groups are attempting to help kids eat better, more regular meals, and to learn good eating habits.
Such a familiar noise. For many of us, it's probably far removed, but that's the sound of about 100 third and fifth graders eating lunch at school. In Albemarle County last year, about 20 of those voices belonged to kids from homes that didn't have adequate access to food. If you lived in Charlottesville, nearly 55 of those 100 children were considered food insecure. And that's just locally. A recent study by Feeding America, a nationwide nonprofit network of food banks, looked at central and western Virginia. They found that in 2013, more than 53,000 kids under the age of 18 weren't sure where they'd get their next meal. That number had grown by more than 1,300 kids since the previous year. Nationally, the group found that nearly one-third of the 49 million people who go hungry in the U.S. every month are children.
Children who are food insecure arrive at school far less prepared to learn.
Michael McKee, the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, explains the effects food insecurity has on children.
They have a much harder time attending to teachers. They might have a harder time staying awake. They're lower energy. They're more easily distracted. They're given to more frequent behavioral challenges. And they're likely to fall behind if not provided with sufficient food. And we know that kids who fall behind by third grade fall further behind and are at higher risk of dropping out of school.
To try and make sure that kids have enough to eat in these formative years, the federal government funds free and reduced lunch programs in schools throughout the country. In order to qualify for free meals, a family of four has to make less than $31,000. Last year, more than half of the 4,000 children enrolled in Charlottesville City Schools received free or reduced lunch. That proportion has held steady since 2007, the year before the recession. Of course, some elementary schools in the system have higher rates, well over 80% most years, while others hover in the 30 to 40% range. In total, last year, Charlottesville City Schools provided roughly 375,000 lunches, 200,000 breakfasts, and 60,000 snacks to kids. Another way the schools are trying to make a difference is with vegetable gardens, like the one I visit at Clark Elementary, which has the highest free and reduced lunch rate in Charlottesville.
Oh, where are those sweet potatoes?
What?
As the kids try new foods like kale chips or asparagus, they also learn where it comes from and what it takes to grow it. The nonprofit group City Schoolyard Garden was started 5 years ago and now boasts educational gardens in 7 out of the 9 Charlottesville City Schools. While nearly every student has a chance to get his or her hands dirty, the group is particularly focused on reaching kids from low-income and food-insecure households. About 2,500 kids participate in the gardens each year, but the program goes beyond teaching kids how to grow kale, asparagus, and dozens of other vegetables. Executive Director Jeanette Abinader explains.
Our vision is that children who are engaged in nature have enhanced academic performance. They cultivate healthy living skills. They learn about community teamwork. So we're using the garden as a lab.
The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank is trying to stem the tide of child hunger with its own program. It's called the Backpack Program, and it spans schools over 6 counties, especially those in rural areas. Eligible students get a backpack full of food every Friday during the school year. But McKee says we can't backpack our way out of child hunger. It's just not a cost-effective model, which leaves him wondering, what more can be done?
We've got to do more, and we've got to figure out how to get to the kids who need us most. How do we get to the kids who have even fewer options?
More than 350,000 senior citizens in Virginia have trouble paying their basic costs of living, including meals. In this next report on food insecurity, Jordy hit the road with the Meals on Wheels program in Charlottesville, which provides the retired and the homebound with daily meals and a little human touch.
Is this a one-way street?
No, it's not.
No, you're good.
We're good.
I'm riding along with 30-year-old Adam Wright. Wright's an airline pilot by trade, but in his off hours, he delivers food for Charlottesville's Meals on Wheels.
Good morning, Mr. Hare.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Every day, 5 days a week, Meals on Wheels delivers about 270 meals to people in the Charlottesville area who are homebound or who can't cook for themselves.
Right now, our age group runs from 23 to 96.
Lee Tripp is the executive director of Meals on Wheels in Charlottesville.
The younger ones tend to have some type of debilitating disease or a mental disorder that does not allow them to care for themselves. But this allows them to live independently because they've got somebody to bring them food every day. But 80% of the people that we serve are over 65, and about 65% are over 75. Wow. So it is mostly an elder population. I mean, we're talking about people who were, you know, the librarian in your school, the postal worker who came to your house every day. You know, they're people that you saw, and then you don't see them anymore, and you don't think about them, but they're there, and they need us.
The Charlottesville Meals on Wheels was started 38 years ago by 4 women in a church basement. They delivered 8 meals a day. Today, that has grown to 4 part-time staff and a network of 180 volunteers. Each meal costs about $5.50. But because most of their clients are too poor to afford the meals, about 3/4 of the 270 daily meals they deliver are fully subsidized through the private donations they receive from local supporters. Tripp says they don't receive any set government funding. Most of the rest of their clients pay a sliding fee, somewhere between $1 and $4 per meal, depending on their income.
They're choosing, if we don't feed them, they're choosing between buying food and paying for their medicine or paying for their home. That's not a fair choice. Nobody should have to make that choice, especially when you get older. I mean, what can they do otherwise? They can't go back to work.
Today they're serving up potatoes, chicken nuggets, and spinach, perhaps?
A handful of volunteers prepare meals in the basement of the Charlottesville headquarters. They're packed into a series of coolers, which are each labeled with a different route number. On a recent Friday, Adam Wright gets Route 15. He's got a total of 10 deliveries, some of which include meals intended to last clients through the weekend, One of those is Hortensia Cruz.
Miss Cruz, got some meals for you. You got a minute for a reporter?
Cruz invites me into her small living room, where we sit and talk for half an hour. She lives by herself and has narcolepsy and a rare illness called stiff person syndrome. It causes her to have random seizures because her senses are extraordinarily heightened. Loud noises, bright lights, sudden touches, these can all send her into convulsions. She wears a giant set of ear protectors around her neck, the kind that lumberjacks or construction workers wear.
Yeah, I cannot go to church, to a movie, to a party, concert, nothing. To a reunion, barbecue, because some people talk loud. And even the hospital, I have to talk in the front desk and ask them, is there a place where I can hide from the noise? And then they put me in a room by myself, so I cannot socialize like I wish I could, you know.
Once she tried to go to the grocery store, but a nearby shopper sneezed loudly. Cruz dropped to the floor as her body began to tense up and spasm. She doesn't know what she'd do without Meals on Wheels. She's scared of cooking for fear that she'd burn her house down if she had a seizure while at the stove. But it's more than just delivering meals to those in need. For many of these folks, this is the only contact they have with another human being throughout the course of the week. Volunteers aren't just delivery drivers. They're also caretakers. Meals on Wheels has emergency contact numbers for everyone they serve. If a volunteer is worried about a client, that number gets called. If they don't answer, the police are there within 30 minutes to check on them.
A couple of times they have had to break in, and they found people on the floor and gotten them to hospitals. Since I've been here, it's all worked out really well.
Knowing they're the only touchstone for many of their clients, Meals on Wheels tries to go one step further, sending birthday and holiday cards to folks as well, reminding them that they're not entirely alone.
I mean, we had one lady called, and she wasn't complaining, but everybody in the office cried over it. She called to tell us that we were the only people in the world who remembered her birthday. And she wasn't doing that to make us feel sorry for her. She was just telling us how appreciative she was that we actually did it. It's hard to think of people being that alone, but they are.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Jordy's award-winning look at hunger in Virginia. He was also honored by the Virginia Association of Broadcasters, along with Jesse Nadler and Christopher Clymer Kurtz, for last year's series on refugees in Virginia. And you'll find all of our special series at WMRA.org. Finally, let's take a look back at the week in Virginia politics from our partner station, WCVE in Richmond. Craig Carper is joined by Richmond Times-Dispatch political analyst Jeff Shapiro.
Jeff, last Saturday, the two men running for governor, Ed Gillespie and Ralph Northam, met for their first debate. Everyone's always watching for a gaffe or a flub, and it didn't seem like we saw one.
Yes, the debate at the Homestead Saturday last was newsworthy because no one seemed to step in it, if you will. That may be a rich image given the early hour. I apologize for that. The debate, of course, was sponsored by the Virginia Bar Association. This is a regular stop for statewide candidates. Now, it was live streamed. It was not carried on television. And I think that's important because had it been carried on television and had someone screwed up, we'd probably still be talking about it and writing about it 6 days on. But Gillespie did not want to talk about President Trump, and he didn't particularly care to talk about health care. And Northam spent a lot of time talking about both and giving these very fuzzy answers about an issue on which he has continued to be quite fuzzy, and that is whether he is for or against these twin natural gas pipelines that would cross the western part of the state.
And in this off year, Virginia and New Jersey's gubernatorial races are usually the main event. But this year, external national issues, i.e. President Trump, continue to overshadow Virginia's campaign.
And of course, with the Republicans who control the U.S. Senate struggling with a replacement for Obamacare, there are some, shall we say, PR opportunities for Democrats here in Virginia. A number of elective officials have been staging these news conferences all around the state, essentially to taunt Ed Gillespie for his refusal to take a public position on these various Republican plans, all of which, according to the numbers crunchers at CBO, would take health care from people. Now, how many in Virginia is not clear. We do know that at least 400,000 Virginians would have coverage in this state had it gone along with Medicaid expansion. Then we had the president's order by tweet that would ban transgender Americans from the military, even thousands on active duty, a story of great sensitivity in a defense-rich state like Virginia. Now, the president's splash has allowed Northam, he's an Army veteran of the first Iraq War, to depict himself as an opponent of discrimination. Gillespie has said he doesn't want any transgender soldiers, sailors, airmen, or Marines who are on active duty from being forced out of the service, but he's deferring to the Pentagon to come up with some policy on whether the ranks in future should be closed to transgender men and women. And on Thursday, Gillespie tried again to change the subject. He was up in Loudoun County, one of those important swing suburbs of Washington, D.C., and there he rolled out plans to control gang violence, plans to improve pay for police officers, plans to strengthen cybersecurity. By the way, Ralph Northam was talking about some Virginia-specific issues as well. He says he wants to improve opportunities for disabled Virginians, and that includes expanding employment for the disabled by at least 20% by 2020. And one last note. Ralph Northam, who's busy trying to replenish his campaign treasury, having spent $8 million in the primary, is watching his opponent go up on television, spending a ton on three commercials, two of them largely biographic, the other focusing on jobs and the economy. And, of course, with paid advertising, Ed Gillespie can talk about what Ed Gillespie wants to talk about. And we know one subject he does not care to discuss is Donald Trump.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Biv and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Jenna Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. All of our stories are archived at that website. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And don't forget to keep up each morning now with the WMRA Daily, our new weekday early morning news podcast. Listen at WMRA.org and sign up for the podcast there. Tell your friends. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay with us now for With Good Reason.